This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio.
Carnegie Hall in New York City, the home of the world's greatest musical events.
In the 1950s, television was a powerful new spotlight in search of a talent that could shine back just as bright.
And here is Mr. Bernstein.
When it landed on Leonard Bernstein, the young conductor more than shined back. His primetime show, Leonard Bernstein's Young People's Concerts with the New York Philharmonic, was a benchmark of quality programming and seduced the entire country.
No matter how many times people tell you stories about what music means, forget them. Stories aren't what music means about at all. Music is never about anything. Music just is. Music is notes, beautiful notes and sounds put together in such a way that we get pleasure out of listening to them. That's all there is to it.
Bernstein was a masterful teacher, explaining classical music with a passion and clarity that couldn't help but influence an entire generation of musicians and artists. In those days, there were far fewer celebrities, and Bernstein was one of the biggest. He wore it well, taking his seat at the piano at the center of the party.
He really enjoyed the public Leonard Bernstein. He loved the kids.
Being Leonard Bernstein.
He loved being famous, and he loved meeting everybody in the world.
And staying in fancy hotels and flying first class, and he'd take us along and share it with us, like, isn't this cool?
Bernstein was a musician, a conductor, a teacher, and a composer of classical music, as well as Broadway musicals. He was also a father.
I'm the bossy one.
Uh-huh. Bernstein and his wife, Felicia, had three children, Jamie, Alexander, and Nina. And while they knew him in the tucks and tails, they also knew him as the dad who loved games. He was a killer at anagrams and always up for tennis or squash or skiing or touch football.
The word games.
Yeah, okay.
You
my
have
God.
No idea.
Yeah.
Two of Bernstein's children, Jamie and Alexander, spoke with me about their legendary father and what it was like to grow up with people like Stephen Sondheim and Jerome Robbins as regular house guests.
When we were really little, Alexander and I used to share a bedroom when we were, like, you know, really little, and we lived in the Osborne, which is that grand old building.
Osborne.
And Alexander and I slept, you know, at sort of right angles to each other in this bedroom, and we would go to sleep listening to the grown-ups carrying on downstairs. This is what we fell asleep to, the noise of the, you know, the laughing and the roaring around the piano
clinking
and singing, the clinking of the glasses,
yeah,
and the smell of the cigarette smoke walking
sure
up the staircase.
Lots of smoke.
We could not wait to be grown-ups, because obviously all grown-ups did was have fun.
That's interesting.
That's how it seemed to us, and it seemed like our dad certainly had fun when he was working, too, so we never saw anything that resembled drudgery, which is probably a thing that most kids perceive in their working parents, that, you know, it's such a tough day.
And what about your mother? Was your mother someone who was his companion and she was along for the ride and all of it and loving it? Or was she someone who was sitting in a room going, when's it going to stop? My eyes, the Energizer bunny with a martini in his hand and a pell-mell in the other.
Scotch, not martini.
Scotch, what Valentine's. Did he smoke?
Valentine's.
A Valentine's beer? Oh, Scotch.
No, Valentine's scotch, which is awful.
Scotch.
I don't know why I liked it so much.
He had a Valentine's. What's brand of cigarettes
and L&M
he
and
smoked? He had an L&M.
Yes.
And she had a Chesterfield.
My grandfather
hand,
smoked Chesterfield.
And a vodka in the other.
But your mother was his trusted companion. She was all in.
Absolutely
she was
all in.
And I think it drove her crazy every bit as much as she loved it all. She was very social,
where
too.
Where was she from?
Chile.
And where did they meet?
They met at a party given by Claudio Arrau, the pianist.
And, who was her teacher, because she was studying piano. Too.
She had told her parents that she was coming to New York to study piano, but she really wanted to be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
So she came
to New York.
She's
a beautiful woman.
And she
gorgeous.
Was a beautiful woman.
Very beautiful.
So she had this understanding with Arrau, that she would be sort of studying with him, but meanwhile she was studying with
I'm
Herbert Berghoff.
I'm going to call my parents. Now, make the sound of the piano in the background.
Claudio. Right.
Claudio, por favor, play some
un
Chopin.
Un poquito de Brahms, por favor.
Un poquito de Debussy, where I call my parents now in
exactly.
South America.
I think it was very much like that.
It was. And the legend has it that our mother sat at his feet and fed him shrimps one by one. That was
Bernstein.
The beginning of the romance.
Yeah.
Yeah, not around.
Bernstein. She might have been doing that.
And they got engaged, but then
where was
they,
he at in his career then?
So he had already had his big debut at the New York Philharmonic, because that was in 1943.
Where he filled in for?
For he filled in the ailing Bruno Walter, as he's always referred to exactly. in that circumstance. Yes. I thought his first name was ailing.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, so this must have been like maybe 4 or 5 years later. So he was riding high, but he was not yet.
That'll be a name I stay in a hotel in from now. I love good names for hotels, but I'm going to stay in a hotel under the name Ailing. Yeah, E-H-L-I-N-G.
That would be
Ailing Bruno Volta.
Ailing Bruno Volta.
Is the name I would use as a hotel. And so the Ailing Bruno Volta, E-H-L-I-N-G, had the flu.
He had the flu, and so.
And your father comes in. What year was that?
That was November 14th, 1943.
Wow.
Good afternoon. United States Rubber Company again invites you to Carnegie Hall to hear a concert of the New York Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra. Bruno Walter, who was to have conducted this afternoon, is ill, and his place will be taken by the young American-born assistant conductor of the Philharmonic Symphony, Leonard Bernstein.
And he had to get up there on a moment's notice, and he'd been up all night the night before because he'd had a premiere of a song cycle of his called I Hate Music, and it had premiered the night before, so of course there was a party.
Where?
A town hall. And it was very well received. And, of course, there was a party afterwards, and they were up all the livelong night. And at the time, you know, our dad was living in Carnegie Hall in those little apartments they used to have at the top.
Yeah.
So he gets back to Carnegie Hall at, you know, 5 in the morning and passes out. And then, like an hour and a half later, the phone rings, and it's Bruno Zerato of the New York Philharmonic saying, "This is it, kid. You have to go on this afternoon." And it was on the radio. It was a national broadcast, which is why it was such a big deal.
Leonard Bernstein has come out on the platform.
It was highly covered in the press, probably because it was the middle of the war and everybody needed a feel-good story.
Yes.
American boy makes good kind of thing. So one guy said, "It's like a shoestring catch in center field. Make it and you're a hero. Muff it and you're a dope." Bernstein made it.
Did he ever reflect on that to you? Meaning when people have that kind of debut. He came up that night and everything changed after that
night. He pretty much knew that it was a sort of Cinderella tale and that he just got this unbelievable lucky break. Yeah.
And did he believe, or was it ever discussed even by your mother or people like that? Did your father realize, he must have, that his sexuality and that his good looks were as much a part of his talent as anything else?
I think there's no doubt about that. And I think
He played it
probably from high school on, you know, and as soon as he started playing the piano and knew he had this incredible talent and could play at parties and get all this attention. And
he had a meeting out of his hand.
Oh, my God.
Or feeding him the shrimp out of their hand.
Yeah.
But at age 25, he was still a little geeky. I mean, the pictures of him with the Philharmonic after the debut, where he's all exhausted and tousled and sweaty, he actually looks like a bar mitzvah boy. He looks a little funny. I think he kind of grew into his grooviness over the subsequent years.
So your father, he had 3 children over 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was that like for him in terms of did he have certain kind of rules in terms of how he protected you from the public and the schools you went to and the way you lived your life? Or was he just very loosey-goosey?
You know,
about
I would say that he was not a big
Was your mother
maker.
In charge?
She
yeah.
was the one who really
she
designed
made the,
the way our lives went on a day-to-day basis. He was busy being the maestro, and then he would come home and play with us and hang out.
And have fun.
But he was not really the designer of the domestic scene.
He was the good cop.
When he was home, he was really home. Right. You know, he didn't have an office to go to. And
when did you become aware of who your father was?
You know, when you're growing up, your family is just your family. You have no objectivity about it. And your parents are just your parents. And you don't really think about how different they might be from the others until you get older. At some point, when we were pretty young, there was an episode of The Flintstones.
What time is it, Betty?
It's 10 minutes to 9.
Betty and Wilma.
Come on, Betty.
We're
going
to go to the Holly Rock Bowl.
I love to watch Leonard Bernstein conduct.
Mm. And the first thing on the program is that gorgeous symphony by Rocky Maninoff.
That's when we knew he had really hit the big time.
That was thrilling. And
how old were you?
Pretty
you were
young.
Kids, little kids.
Yeah, 9 and 6. Not,
probably
like
or even less.
Was there a downside to it? Did you feel like there were things that were tough for you with him?
Looking back on it now, or when we got older, probably look back and think about some downsides. But at the time, it really didn't seem so bad at all. It was a lot of fun.
When we were really little, it was just a lark. I often try to think back to, come on, you know, there must have been some shadows. But we had a pretty fantastic early childhood. It was kind of wonderful.
He's not some tortured introspective. He was a happy guy, and he was a celebrity.
He was tortured and introspective.
He was.
But back in those early days of our family life, that was overshadowed by the joy and the happiness, the busyness and the family life and
he
all
kept
of that.
From you.
We sure
was
never
on the
saw
ascendant.
It.
Yeah.
He kept that from you.
I'll tell you, in my memory, the moment when it changed was November 22nd, 1963, the day JFK was assassinated. That was when the shadow fell over and life became sort of real. Up until that point, you know, grown-ups just had fun, as far as we could perceive. And then that day, we saw our parents fall apart. Mm-hmm. They were crying because they were friends of the Kennedys.
Of
they had been to the White House. They had had dinner, just the four of them, imagine.
They had been centerpieces of Kennedy's cultural programming in the White House.
Yeah. So
their father was what he brought into the White House.
They could not have been more connected to the Kennedy administration and everything that it stood for. So on that day when he was assassinated, our parents just fell apart, and so did the whole rest of the family and all their friends, and they pulled down the shades and sat around crying all day and just watched TV. Now we could perceive that there were shadows and that there were ups and downs. That wasn't visible to us until
that
time.
How the world itself can affect people psychologically.
Yeah.
What about your mom in terms of her music appreciation? I mean, she studied the piano, but did she go on to have any kind of a serious career, even in her young years when she was with Rao? Did she play? Did she study? Once she met and married your father, did all that stop?
Her piano playing stopped. She would play sometimes at home and quite beautifully.
But she wasn't as passionate about it.
No.
What was she passionate about?
She was passionate about her acting. She kept at that. Sometimes she would...
And what were some of the things she was working on during her career?
She did a lot of early television, Playhouse 90 and Kraft Theater
Studio
and
One.
All those live dramas that they had.
In New York.
In early television. Yeah. She did a lot of that and a lot of stage work.
Did that stop at some point?
It kind of... receded as she became Mrs. Maestro and a mom, which was a double job that could keep anybody
of course
busy 24/7.
And was she generally happy to do those things? Or did she ever voice? Because it's interesting to me to have someone who is in the world of music herself. She studied with Rao. It's a serious opportunity there. She had aspirations about music and acting. And did she miss those things? Did she ever say, gosh, if only? Did she have a little bit of a wistfulness about it?
I think she was pretty ambivalent about it.
Yeah, she didn't really talk a lot about her inner self too much.
Aha.
What she did talk about a little bit was that she had some stage fright issues. And so when she started performing less in public, she would say that she was relieved. And that being, you know, this Mrs. Bernstein persona was a way of not having to confront her fears about performing. But I think, you know, anybody who has performed has a part of them that still wants to perform. But she knew that like it was just going to be too hard to have these, you know, two rampant egos in the household.
Probably a good call. Coming up, more about Bernstein's early years in Massachusetts and his final concert at Tanglewood, which his brother described as Lenny coming home to die. This is Alec Baldwin. I'm talking with two of Leonard Bernstein's children, Jamie and Alexander. You're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio.
I see someone like your dad who sounds very childlike, did the Young People's Concerts, father, fun and joy and family and love, bursting with love. Leonard Bernstein is someone to me who, when he's on the podium, love is just shooting out of him like a rainbow.
You got it.
Love of this and love of that and love of life and love of sex and love of sound and love of women and love of beauty. And I wonder, was it because as the result of his classical training, did he not have enough childhood?
His childhood was not about music.
He was raised where?
He was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and then shortly thereafter they moved to the Boston area. First they lived in Roxbury.
And moved a lot.
They moved around a lot.
What did his dad do?
He was a hair product salesman.
He was a salesman?
Yeah.
And his mom, was she musical?
Not in the least.
How did the music get into his life?
Well, here's the thing. There was this Aunt Clara who moved to Florida, and so she sent all her furniture over to her brother Sam's house. And along with all the couches and break fronts arrived this upright piano. Our dad was 10 years old. The piano got hauled into the house, and as our father told it, he touched the piano, and that was it. He knew. It's one of those stories. And he taught himself theory. He just played the piano. He could figure it all out.
And 10 is late in the modern world.
And the thing about his dad, Sam Bernstein, is that Sam, you know, it was a depression, but Sam was very proud that he was able to tide his family over the depression because he had this very successful beauty supply business, the Samuel J. Bernstein Hair Company. In Boston, yeah. It's Bernstein, was right. The slogan. And he had the New England franchise for the Frederick's Permanent Wave Machine.
Right. And everybody knows that even in a depression, there's two things you don't let go of, booze and vanity.
Correct.
There you go.
You can have your
and
hair
so
done.
All those women would go and be attached to that machine that looks like Bride of Frankenstein, you know? They were all doing it. So they got through the depression, and Sam was so proud that he was able to pass the Samuel J. Bernstein Hair Company along to his eldest son to run. And, of course, Lenny had no intention of running the Samuel J. Bernstein Hair Company in Boston. It's Bernstein. And it was a real problem between
even
the two
of
them.
Even though he had a great head of hair.
Yes, he did.
He had a swell head of hair. Then what happened?
And Sam was not going to let him be a klezmer musician, you know.
Because he came from the old
weddings
country.
And funerals, and that was it. You know, that's what a musician does.
In the old country, that a musician was a beggar, a homeless sure. guy who went from shtetl to shtetl playing the fiddle and getting a few kopecks at the wedding. You call that a living?
So what happened?
So little by little, it became clear that he was immensely talented at this, and it went to the Boston Latin School and then to Harvard. And
he gets to Harvard to study what? Music.
No, they had no music department.
Right. No music department then.
No.
You couldn't major in it. So was he a literature guy?
Yeah. So he was born in 1918.
Yeah, 1918. Yeah. So he's there, you know.
Class of 39.
39. It's
no music department at Harvard there in the just immediately prior to the war. None.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he leaves Harvard, where does he go?
He goes to Curtis
Institute.
So Curtis
Institute
is where
for one
he
year.
Goes to the next level. He was yeah. Curtis is where yeah. the music.
But at Harvard, he's writing music. He's putting on shows constantly.
But Curtis is the real temple of musical study that he enters.
Yeah,
and this is the real formalizing of his musical education.
And he studies with Fritz Reiner.
Right.
You know,
right.
studies conducting.
It all goes up a big level here.
A big level. And it was tough. Yeah. He was very lonely. It was a tough year or two for him at Curtis.
He's there for how long?
A little over a year, I think.
And then what happens?
A long time. And then he came to New York.
Desperate to find work.
He was ready to hit New York and
to do what?
He wrote
arrangements
and stuff under an assumed name,
Lenny Amber. He arranged Ornette Coleman charts. He did all sorts of weird things. Didn't he do a four hands version of El Salón México for Aaron Copland?
Well, that was the big thing. He got to know Aaron Copland.
Okay, how did that happen?
That he was still in college when he met Aaron.
Harvard or Curtis?
Harvard,
yeah.
So at Harvard, he meets Copland under what circumstances? Because if he's not in a music program, how does he rub shoulders with Copland?
I think he gets invited to.
He came to New York for the weekend.
To New York.
He was invited to.
So he's seeking out and sniffing out the musical world, even though he's at Harvard.
And he's at a concert, I think.
It was a
ballet
performance.
And he's sitting next to Aaron.
Ooh.
And they get to know each other.
And it turned out to be Aaron's birthday. And Aaron invited our dad back to his loft for the party.
So Clara ships the piano to the house. That's ooh moment number one. He gets seated next to Copland. Ooh, moment number two.
And then goes to the birthday party and plays Copland's piano variations in front of the whole crowd, which our dad was in the habit of doing, and clearing rooms because it's a very gnarly piece. And so he said, are you sure you want me to play it at this party? Because it usually clears the room. And Aaron said, not at this party.
And he played it and didn't clear the room.
He did not clear that room.
Yeah, it's all of Copland's contemporaries. And he plays, and a friendship and a relationship with Copland commences there.
Right. Lifelong.
And other than, I would say, probably as much, if not more, than Slatkin, your father was one of the great interpreters of Copland. I mean, the two of them were my two favorites. Bernstein and Slatkin are my two favorite Copelandizers. And then what is the quick series of steps that gets him to the associate directorship of the Philharmonic?
I think an introduction to Koussevitzky, going to Tanglewood, conducting at Tanglewood.
So he's a guest conductor at Tanglewood.
He's a student.
He's a student conductor at
Tanglewood. Student
at the Tanglewood Orchestra.
Tanglewood
had just been invented by Koussevitzky, and our dad was in that first class.
And so Koussevitzky is the one who builds Tanglewood. He's the music director of the BSO, who oversees the construction of that. What are some of your best memories of your dad there? What would you do? Remember, what was his? Go ahead. Give me. You're laughing.
Well, we're laughing because our dad loved to go to Tanglewood so much his entire life. Every time he went up there, it was like he would be rejuvenated. He would turn into a kid again.
It's a holy place.
It's a holy place. And what he really loved was being with all those
kids.
Can
we say that again, that the Berkshires is a holy place? So your father loved it there.
We both worked at Tanglewood.
What did you do?
I went for a few more years than Jamie.
We were guides,
ooh, which was, it's a fancy name for just doing anything that they need to be done. But, you know, you man the gates and you show people around. That was the guide part. Sometimes there would be tours. And also you would help backstage and help the artists and move them around and pick them up at the airport, stuff like that. And it was just heaven to be up there for a summer.
And there was also this sense, I think our dad had it from the very beginning, that, you know, everybody was sort of out in this beautiful weather, in this beautiful place with all these fun people, and there would be shenanigans.
Yeah.
We just fell right into the shenanigans sensibility of the place, that, you know, it was just fun and everybody was partying all night and you know, having romances and
it's funny you say that because it is probably one of the two or three most romantic places I've ever been. I mean, you can go, for those people listening who don't know, the Tanglewood is in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, and it's the summer residency of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And you go up there to Lenox, massive piece of land. It's a massive tract of land. And in that way, in a good way, that you can talk about going somewhere with someone and driving that decompressing road trip, that as you drive and drive and get closer and closer, you just feel your body relaxing. And then you get to have the excitement of going to Tanglewood. And you go and you get your basket and your food and your wine.
That's
and
the real fun, is to be out on the lawn, the lawn under the stars.
The lawn is even better in a way if you've got the basket and the girl and the wine or whatever your preference is there. And I think I've never seen more people who are getting it right, you know what I mean, in terms of having a lovely evening. And if they get smashed on top of it, you know. I guess what I'm saying is there's nothing like getting smashed at Tanglewood.
Ain't the truth.
It's the best kind of
smash.
You
know, the year I was a guide there was the year...
No comment.
The year that I was a guide there was the year the Fillmore East came up there, like three different times, and I saw
The Who
and Jimi Hendrix at the shed.
You're saying that Bill...
Graham
had his production company, Fillmore East, meaning as a production company.
Yeah, they came up in a convoy of Ryder trucks.
And Sly.
With all those Marshall amps.
And played The Shed.
Who played?
The Who played The Shed?
And
played
I
the
was... Shed?
That's
I
like
was...
a bathroom to them.
We'd like to say what a real pleasure it is to be back in Tanglewood again. We were only here last August.
They trashed that lawn. That's why they were never invited back.
Sit down!
You would not have wanted to see
that
lawn the next day.
If I was on that board, isn't it funny how we've changed? Back then, I would have been The Who. Now I'm like, we're not having them here. We can have their likes here in Tanglewood.
They tried it.
Who else did Graham bring
Mr. Kiley, who ran the head of the groundskeepers, was just beside himself.
Yeah. He had a coronary.
It was a disaster.
Your father loved it there, though.
He loved it, and he loved to stay up all night yakking with the students. That was what really...
Who did your dad admire in his constellation? Who did he... I heard a story once from someone. They said that they were at your family's home, and your father's standing there with a cigarette in his hand and a drink in the other, and someone says, "I just came from seeing the Beatles." And the quote was a very simple one. They said that Bernstein said, turned to my friend and said, "You came and saw the Beatles?" He says, "I can't wait to see them myself." He said, "I'm mad for them." And he just had a passion for all disparate forms of music.
Absolutely true.
He did. He really did love the Beatles a lot. And we were so lucky as we were growing up because I was a complete Beatle maniac.
Sure.
And my dad loved their music too. So together, we would discover the Beatles, and when they had a new album, I would run out and get it and go straight to my father's studio and say, look, I've got Rubber Soul. And he'd say, great, let's put it on right now. And we'd stick the record on. And I learned more about music by listening to the Beatles with my dad than I think I did any other way.
You know, my dad passed away. He was very young. My dad was only 55. He was a year older than I am now. He had a very rare form of cancer. And he died of lung cancer when he was 55. And your dad didn't live a very long life either. How old were both of you when your dad passed away?
Well, he died at 72, which is not...
45, I was.
You were?
35.
And I was 39.
So you were grown adult people.
Yeah, but like you, our mother died when she was 56, and we were much younger when that happened. She died in 1978, so we were in our... early 20s, and
your
our
dad
sister,
died in what year?
He died 90. In 1990.
Right.
So by then we were, you know, adults more or less. But when our mother died, we were still a very young family. Nina was only 15 or something.
But did your mother die from?
Lung cancer.
Right. Was she a smoker?
Yep.
My point is that your dad didn't live a very long life.
Did he die suddenly,
or did he get sick and he knew he was in trouble?
He was sick for like 6 months of being really sick.
He was diagnosed with?
He had all sorts of chest problems,
sure,
you know, through his life, but it was not cigarette related.
Mesothelioma,
which was probably an asbestos thing when he was a kid, or who knows.
Right.
I mean, it didn't help that he smoked, obviously, but...
Right.
And he had emphysema.
It's a combination. Yeah.
But, you know, just the having the oxygen and stuff, that was the last, you know, month or so. He died in October, and his last concert was at Tanglewood
in August of 1990.
So
he could barely get through the
last
performance,
thing
but
your father conducted was a public performance in
Beethoven
the summer.
7, yeah.
He did the Beethoven 7.
Yep.
At Tanglewood in August of 1990.
Yep.
And died that October. I think about your dad, and did he just, when he knew he was sick and he knew he was in trouble, health-wise, because my dad knew he was in trouble. I mean, there was a moment I had with my dad where he looked at me with this look in his eye like he knew it was over. And he had a tear run down his face, and my father said, "I'll never know my grandchildren." And when I think about this with your dad, a guy like that who had so much more he wanted to do, did he ever express that to you? Did he ever talk about that? He wasn't done?
Yeah, he did, you know, and I think... you know, he had this fantastic climactic moment at the very end of 1989, the year before he died, when he conducted at the fall of the Berlin Wall, and he did the Ode to Joy, and instead of singing Freude, which means joy, they sang Freiheit, which means freedom. It was such a big deal for him to be there when the Berlin Wall came down, and it was such a momentous occasion.
Where were you when that happened?
I wish I had been there. And in retrospect, I regret that I wasn't there, but I had just given birth to my son, Evan, like less than 8 weeks earlier.
So you have an excuse.
That was my excuse. So I watched it on the couch on Christmas Day while I was nursing my infant son. I watched it on TV because they showed the whole thing in a live broadcast.
What about you?
I don't even have an excuse, and I can't remember why I didn't go. I can't believe that I wasn't there. It's just unbelievable.
You know, we didn't know he was going to be gone within the year. So, you know, he was always there, and there were always these occasions where you could go and meet him on the road, and there were hundreds of them, and it was kind of a pain to go get in with that whole retinue and the whole madness of the tour thing. And so
by then
only...
it had become Entourage City, you know.
Right after that, he got really sick with a flu. And
what year was that?
1989.
Yeah.
It was like
at the fall itself.
Christmas of 1989. And I remember visiting him about a month later, less than a month later, in Key West. And he was just not feeling right. And he told me so. He said, I don't feel right. That was the beginning of the slow decline. And then things got a lot worse in May. And then he just kind of struggled through all his gigs over the summer and then barely made it through that Beethoven 7. We were all in the audience clutching each other's hands like, is he going to make it? Is he going to make it?
Because what was his life like after your mom passed away? He didn't remarry, did he?
No, he did not. And
why do you think
he was so miserable for a long time after she died?
He needed her.
He needed her, and he was just devastated.
He wasn't prepared for that at all.
A long, long time until we went on vacation. Probably, I don't know, 8 months later, something like that. And we started seeing signs of a person again.
Tell about what happened in Jamaica. After the Christmas dinner, and then we went to the bar.
Oh my God. This was the vacation in Jamaica, our family and a couple of friends. And we went down to the bar, and there were probably a couple of people in there. And he sits down at the piano in the bar. And this was after dinner, after, you know, a lot of scotch, whatever, a lot of wine. And he plays Rhapsody in Blue from beginning to end. It was the most amazing performance you could possibly imagine. I mean, he just ripped it. It was just unforgettable, and then that's kind of when I knew he was back. He was just...
Through the music.
He was, yeah.
He tells you where he's at through the music.
Oh, my God. So, obviously, he never married again, but...
Why do you think he never married again? You see a guy like that, you mean, my God, he could have had any woman in New York. He didn't have room in his life for that anymore?
No, and there were some men that he was very close to, and... Right.
And would you say that once your mother passed away, was your father's life as a bisexual man, did he just live it more vividly once your mother was gone? Was he much more living color about it?
His mother was still alive.
Oh.
And I think that played a great role in
that. Was kind of a governor there that prohibited
it. Was kind of a governor, yeah.
And then when she died,
also,
when he
still had a public.
It was a different time.
She outlived him.
Yeah.
She was 92 when he died, and she said memorably, "This will shorten my life."
Wow. And so he, you think that he kept that quiet and kept that private, not only because was that his nature, to be a little more private?
It was
private
partly
with
his nature. He sort of came out sort of a few times. He was hoping people would take more notice of it than they did, I think. But I think he didn't want his mother to have to deal with it with her friends and, you know, have people talking about
it. If he was alive now, how old would that be?
If he was alive now, he'd 95, be 90.
I think.
Yeah.
Be 95.
Yeah, centennial will be 2018.
Who was someone, I'm sure there were boundless people because your father was very generous of heart, it seems, and very passionate. But who were some of the people other than Koussevitzky and Copeland that we've covered before? Who were some of the people that were contemporaries of your father that you remember him speaking very glowingly about? Who did he admire?
Lucas Foss would be one.
They were at Curtis together. That's where they met. And they stayed friends and colleagues their entire lives. And Lucas was a stupendous pianist in addition to being an excellent composer. So he played our dad's Age of Anxiety, which is a sort of like a piano concerto, although it's called a symphony. And Lucas could just play the hell out of it. And our dad premiered many of Lucas's pieces with the Philharmonic. And
they were so close
that
friends.
Was he
so
was one of them. Michael Tilson Thomas was someone that our dad kind of nurtured along when
he was
when
Tilson Thomas's Kuzovitsky to a degree.
Yes, to a degree.
So who else did he mentor?
Oh, well, he was Mr. Mentor.
Seiji Ozawa to a great degree, I think.
My God.
John Malcheri.
Another guy with great hair. Seiji. Great hair.
Great
the great
hair,
hair school of conducting. Oh, yes. Nothing absolutely. Like that hair flying through the air. Looks great.
It's amazing how many great hair conductors there are, isn't
yeah.
it?
So Ozawa.
Right. Well, when he was conducting at the Philharmonic.
What was his relationship with Sondheim?
Oh, that was a big, big relationship. Big friendship and colleagueship.
Sure.
You know, West Side Story
Jerry
changed
Robbins.
Their lives forever.
All of them had this phenomenal success.
Yeah.
Initially, West Side Story was supposed to be, if I'm right, an Irish-Jewish gang.
Yeah.
Lower East Side.
It was going to be East Side Story.
It was going to be Lower East Side Story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tempers would flare over the Easter Passover holidays.
Right. The shillelaghs versus the
mezuzahs.
The mezuzahs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. And then apparently Jerry Robbins saw some article about gang wars with Puerto Ricans on the Upper West Side, and he went, ding, you know. The bulb.
It was Jerry.
Arthur
always said it was Arthur, so I don't know.
Oh, maybe it was Arthur.
Probably the most romantic line in a movie I've ever heard, and it always brings me to tears when he turns to her. They have the moment at the dance, and he turns to her and says, "You're not lying to me, are you?" And she says, "I have not yet learned to lie about such things."
That's right. I have not yet learned to joke that way. I think now
is that
I
it?
Never
You're not
will.
Joking with
is
me.
That what she says? Yeah. You're not joking. I have not yet learned to joke. Give it to me again?
Yeah.
Wait, here we go. Ready?
Okay.
You say it.
Okay.
Here we go. We're going to have a live performance. Go.
You're not joking with me?
I have not yet learned to joke that way. I think now I never will.
There you go. There it is.
And the reason we're laughing is because there's a recording of our dad conducting West Side Story in a recording session, and he got Alexander and my sister Nina to do that dialogue.
There's so much to believe. You're not joking me?
I have not yet learned how to joke that way. I think now I never will.
Now, speaking of films, your father only composed, I mean, other than them transferring West Side to a film, your father only composed one film score.
That's right.
And it was a hell of a film score.
Hell of a film score.
And very Bernstein-esque. And why do you think he only did? Your father's someone, I mean, I see people, this is interesting because I see so many people, Billy Joel, Sting. I mean, you see Elton John make his foray into that, but I see so many people who I think to myself, Billy especially, who's a friend, I say, my God, you could be doing so much music, a movie score if you wanted to, and they just don't. They don't have a passion for it. Why did your father just do the one, do you think?
Well, because he really did not enjoy the experience.
Why?
Because he was being bossed around.
Kazam.
Yeah, well, what happened, the example he gave was that he wrote, you know, this soaring music that the dynamics that he composed were all in his head and all recorded a certain way. And then when they're mixing, they just dunk the fader on it so that, as our dad put it, so that you could hear Marlon Brando's grunt. And so just at the climactic moment of his love music, you know, in the final mix, they just dunked the fader.
They would say, okay, we need 15 bars of passion and then, you know, 30 seconds of, you know,
quivering bow.
And he just couldn't write that
Think
way.
Think that so way.
It was impossible. Yeah.
He loved the movie,
but he just hated doing the work.
You have children?
I have a daughter, yes.
You have a daughter who's how old?
She'll be 14 in 2 weeks.
You have a daughter that's 14?
Yeah.
And what is she into? What does she do?
She's into her first year of high school and loving it, and she's into theater in a big way. She loves to
You're raising act your kids in the city or outside the city?
In the city.
You're raising your daughter inside the city. And she likes acting.
She likes acting, but she's also, you know, she loves her English class and history class and
math.
Her school and her friends and her...
What about you?
I have two. I have
and
a
how
daughter.
How old are they now?
They're in their 20s now. They're in their early 20s.
What do they do?
My daughter, Frankie, lives in Brooklyn. She's a writer. And my son is still in school up in the Berkshires, as a matter of fact. He's up in, he lives in Lee, Massachusetts.
Now, well, you know, for both of you, your children, I mean, obviously they know, they didn't have to watch. In their case, they weren't watching Leonard Bernstein. that wasn't the cartoon, wasn't the gateway into an understanding of who their grandfather
was. That's true.
But they know who he is.
Oh, yeah.
And have you had, and do they have an appetite and a passion to understand who he is and see who he is?
My kids don't. They're very careful about sort of keeping their distance from that whole connection. I think it makes them a little shy, a little anxious. And so they don't embrace it.
What do you think that's based on, without getting too personal? Because I have an opinion about that because of my daughter.
Oh, really?
Well, what they want is that they sense that celebrity has become so exponentially out of control now, and they prefer their privacy. If knowing that I was related directly to Leonard Bernstein was going to lead to something appropriate or comfortable or right, that would be one thing. But nowadays, everybody's after the wrong thing. And it's
That's really interesting. I mean, I think about that a lot because our father really loved being famous, and we had fun with it, and it was just a different type of thing in those days.
It was different.
It's more of an industry now.
Right.
And he started seeing that more and more starting in the 80s, and he talked about it a lot. And he once said to me, "I'm so sick of Leonard Bernstein. Mm-hmm. I've had it with him."
I've always had a problem about time. But when I had a problem about time at the age of 25 or 30, when you're still, at least in part, thinking you're immortal and nothing's ever going to change the way you are or abbreviate it, everything's all right. I mean, I would go on concert tours and compose in the airport or on the plane or on the train. I wrote half of The Age of Anxiety in airports and trains and hotels. I can't do that anymore. And it's been some time since I could. One of the reasons is one's standards get higher and higher. Self-identification with the composer whose works you are performing becomes closer and closer to the point where there are performances which are the ones I call good performances. But I know it's been a really good performance. It's one in which I have the feeling I've written the piece, standing there. And when it's over, I don't know where I'm standing.
As he grew older, Bernstein's connection to the music of Gustav Mahler, whom he had championed throughout his career, became even stronger.
I think he felt a deep association, I mean, apart from the music itself, obviously, an association with Mahler as a conflicted musician, Mahler being Jewish and in a
tortured
non-Jewish world, and being a tonal composer in a more atonal world, becoming so, being a European man who came to America, you know, somebody from the classical tradition coming to America and suddenly finding themselves in this crazy world. So I think there was an affinity there.
Plus he was the combination of composer and conductor,
yeah,
which there aren't that many of.
I would love to have known your father. Your father was so singular and remains so singular because, number one, whenever he came on, I was happy. And whenever he came on, I was excited. And he never disappointed me. And when I would see him, I'd say, what you get from Bernstein, you can only get from Bernstein. He was the original in his field. Leonard Bernstein's children, Jamie and Alexander, say their father was so original in part because he just never stopped celebrating music, celebrating life.
He never slept. He was a terrible insomniac. I think that's probably why he managed to squeeze in so much action. He was always at it, you know?
I wish he was around. He and I could have hung out together.
Oh.
I'm an insomniac. I mean, could you imagine? Bernstein and I in your kitchen watching YouTube together?
You could have come over at 4 a.m. and you could have hung out.
God, we could have been watching old movies together. And
yeah, and you would have gone to the piano and played all the old
Bernard Herrmann scores.
Exactly. Yes, everything.
This is Alec Baldwin. To learn more about Leonard Bernstein and Artful Learning, an educational organization that his son Alex spearheads, go to heresthething.org. Here's the Thing comes from WNYC Radio.